Hello and welcome to our podcast, In the Same Vein. I'm Dr. Christy Slobogan.
I'm Spencer Meduzadeh. I'm a second year medical student at the University of Rochester.
And today we are interviewing Dr. Michael Brown.
Dr. Brown is a cultural historian of modern Britain. His interests include medicine and surgery, gender, the body, emotions, and war. And his current work focuses on the emotions surrounding 19th century British surgery. The book that we'll be discussing today is called Emotions and Surgery in Britain, 1793 to 1912, in which he explores the role that feelings played in shaping surgical identities and in structuring relations between surgeons and their patients. He's also currently developing two other research projects, one of which concerns the history of the hand in Victorian Britain, and the other explores material and emotional history of militarism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Yeah, so in this episode, we cover a lot of ground. We're largely talking about that book, but we talk about, obviously, emotions, surgery, we talk about anesthesia, we talk about the myth of the surgeon and kind of the big characters of the 19th century in particular. And then we talk about how things like class, race, and gender have influenced the emotional expectations of patients in that period. So it's a really interesting conversation. And then do you want to say why you chose this book as the focus for this episode of the podcast and why you wanted to talk to Michael Brown?
Sure. So of all the options that we were considering for my episode with Dr. Slobogan, I related most to this book in particular, based in my own experiences with medical school and with anesthesia in particular. Firstly, our very first experience in medical school is dissecting a human body through the anatomical gift program. And this is a very emotional experience for a lot of people, myself included. I felt like treating the donor as our hypothetical first patient was a fascinating way to both compartmentalize a lot of the fear and anxiety that dissecting brought, but also exert compassion through exploring the human body in that way. I also, this summer, attended with a lot of anesthesiologists in the OR, and learning about pain and patients' anxieties going into surgery is interesting enough now, but the harrowing idea of approaching an operation without any pain management really stuck with me, and a lot of the testimony that Dr. Brown provides from patients and surgeons has been really fascinating to read. So I'm excited to have this conversation.
Well, yeah, I'm so glad that you chose this book, and let's get into it. Okay, thank you so much for joining us. We are so happy to have you here, and we might as well just jump into the first question.
So my first question for you, Dr. Brown, is what led you to want to focus on emotion in the history of surgery? And for those who are listening who aren't aware of this field, what is the history of emotions?
Yeah, I'll take the second question first in a way, because I think it's relevant context. I've been asked this before by people, but to talk about the history of the emotions as a relatively new field, but actually it's a pretty well-established field now. People often talk about it like it's new all the time, but it's been around for, since at least the 1980s as a kind of subfield of history, although I guess it's only really in the last sort of 10 to 15 years that it's kind of come of age. But I guess in very simple terms, it's thinking about the place of feeling in historical experience and in kind of past societies. And I think there's been a general assumption, there was a general assumption among historians and among others that emotions were fairly ahistorical, that, anger now is the same as anger in the past, that the various kind of emotional states that we might now experience are relatively unchanging. And I think what the history of emotions has done is, it's kind of complicate that and demonstrated how emotions are in many ways structured by historical context and change over time. And I think what's really interesting about what the history of emotions can add to our understanding is that they both go to ideas about human experience, right, of individual experience, of the ways in which we are in the world, are and how the role that feeling plays in them. But there's also kind of politics of emotions, right? And how, what's permissible to feel, what emotions are given expression, what emotions are not given expression, changes over time, and kind of shapes things like, you know, political discourse or indeed professional practice, which is what I've tried to do in this book. And I think I've tried to do sort of both of those things in the book, both thinking about emotions as a kind of a structuring, a way of structuring experience, but also as a kind of a political culture within kind of particular fields of practice. And so what led me to it, I guess, it really came from an article that I wrote a good few years ago now on a London surgeon by the name of Bransby Cooper and his botched operation for lithotomy in the late 1820s, in 1828. Lithotomy is the removal of bladder stones, and which was an extremely invasive procedure in this period, probably one of the most invasive procedures of the early 19th century, one of the most painful to endure. And he undertook an operation in front of a large audience at Guy's Hospital in 1828, which went very badly wrong. It took over an hour. He became very flustered. He lost his composure. The patient was kind of writhing in agony and screaming. And he repeatedly kind of looked to the audience and to his fellow surgeons for support and so on. And this operation was received very, very critically by one particular section of the medical press, by The Lancet, a radical reforming medical journal founded a few years before that by Thomas Wackley. And what I was interested in is the ways in which kind of Cooper's performance were kind of critiqued in terms of his emotional disposition. So it was his failure to retain emotional self-control. It was his failure to maintain control over the emotions of the patient. And the kind of even his sense of not his inability to maintain control of the room were kind of couched in, you know, in terms of his kind of his emotional disposition, his demeanor. And equally, The Lancet itself, in critiquing him, sought to rouse emotions of pity, sympathy, outrage, anger on the part of the readership. So I thought, you know, this thing is saturated by feeling. And it occurred to me when writing this that actually no one had really written extensively about what it felt like to be operated on in a period when there was no pain relief and when, you know, surgical mortality was murderously high. And so I thought, well, you know, what were the emotions of pre-anesthetic surgery and how did they change after the introduction of anesthesia? So that was a kind of really, it seemed like to me like an obvious thing to explore that hadn't really been explored before. And so, yeah, that's what really led me to embark on this project.
Great. Thank you so much.
Fascinating. Yes. So you mentioned like emotional management in the OR, especially without anesthesia. Can you comment on what emotions would best encapsulate the experience of surgery for patients and for surgeons?
Yes. It's complex. The classic historical answer, right? It's complicated, because I think one of the things I wanted to challenge in my research, one of the kind of overarching stereotypes of the pre-anesthetic surgeon, is this idea that in order to operate in a world in which there was no pain relief, surgeons kind of steeled themselves to endure that experience by kind of cultivating a dispassionate attitude, well, detached, emotionally detached attitude from their patient's sufferings. That they had to, right? That it was a necessary kind of a necessary corollary of pre-anesthetic surgery. And actually, when I kind of dug deeper into the archives, when I kind of, you know, explored the literature in greater detail, it seemed to me that this was, you know, this is not the case, right? That surgeons are not speaking about their practice in entirely dispassionate terms. That isn't to say that they are over emotionally invested, or that they are openly weeping during surgery. Although there are cases where surgeons do shed a tear both before and after surgery. Most famously, or possibly the most famous personal account of undergoing operative surgery in the pre-anesthetic era, is that by Frances Burney about her mastectomy in 1811. And Dominique Jean Larise, one of the surgeons who undertakes that, very famous French surgeon, surgeon to the Grande Armée, to Napoleon's army, he basically says to her, look, I'm so distraught by the idea of your suffering that I wanted to leave, get myself a posting on the other side of France so I couldn't attend you because it was too much for me. And actually, he does shed tears during the procedure itself. So there are people who do that. But for the most part, surgeons see their role as kind of, you know, doing their duty with compassion, understanding the emotional state of their patient, feeling for their patient, but also restraining their own feelings during the course of the operation in order to kind of practice effectively. And there's an example I give in the book, which I think is really nice, of a surgeon who basically says that when we're operating on a patient, we are, you know, it's like a kind of a mother running into a burning building to rescue her child, you know, that we don't think about ourselves. We just do it because we have to, because it's the right thing to do. And it's interesting that he couches, I think, his emotional disposition in terms of, you know, a woman's duty of care rather than kind of heroic masculinity, which I think is quite indicative of some of the values of the period. But certainly I think that surgeons would see their role as being compassionate and caring towards their patients, in as much as also they need to understand their patient's emotional state in order to understand how much they can bear, whether they can undergo an operation in the first place, because it's important to think that, you know that in this period, emotions aren't just some kind of, how shall I say, they're not just an epiphenomenal part of surgical practice. They aren't just, you know, the fluff around it. They're integral to understanding the likelihood of a procedure succeeding and the likelihood of a patient recovering. Because if they say, if a patient isn't emotionally, if they're prone to anxiety, if they're prone to mental despondency, they will die, right? They will die on the operating table, or they will die afterwards from despondency. So a surgeon needs to kind of understand those factors and take them into account when planning a procedure and then also when caring for a patient afterwards. In terms of the patient's disposition, what surgeons praise, I think, or value most of all is an emotional resolve and a certain stoicism and fortitude. Fortitude is the word that they often deploy when thinking about patient demeanor in the operating theatre, because fortitude allows you to undergo this, you know, what is to us an unimaginably grueling, you know, experience. Anxiety is natural. They'll say that it's natural to be anxious about, you know, having someone cut into you while you're conscious. But if you have a bleak or a despondent or a melancholy frame of mind, that's real danger. So a patient who's kind of confident in their own recovery and willing to steel themselves during the operation is ideal, basically. And that's what they tend to praise, that kind of behavior. Because, of course, this is also a situation you've got to remember, you know, patients have to be, in a sense, contained in the operating theater, right? Because it's almost impossible for us to imagine now operating on someone while they are conscious and while they are physically capable of resisting, right? So you don't really want to have to hold someone down. You don't really want to have to, you know, tie them to the table. You want them to be able to hold themselves down, to control themselves in the most unimaginable of painful circumstances. And so therefore, that's the idealized patient, is the patient who exhibits that kind of fortitude and that stoicism.
We're both over here saying we would not be those patients.
No, I don't. I think there's very few of us who are, I think, or would be. I mean, one of the things that struck me in reading, you know, all this archival material is just, you know, there is, of course, that sense of gratitude that none of us have to experience that now. But that just, I don't know how I would approach something like this. You know, it's just unimaginable. It's like there's a, as I said somewhere else, you know, there's a phenomenological gulf that separates us from that world that we simply can't cross, I don't think. It's impossible for us to imagine the prospect of being operated on without, not only without anesthesia, but also with a fairly certain expectation that you would die. You know, with very low expectation that you would live. And I think that's what's kind of really, really remarkable to us. I mean, it's why I start the book with George Wilson, who was an Edinburgh professor who had an operation to remove his foot in the 1840s, just before the advent of anaesthesia. His timing was kind of, you know, unfortunate in that sense. But, you know, he talks about, I had to basically take a week to prepare myself, not only for the experience, but I had to prepare myself to die. I had to make myself spiritually ready to kind of, you know, to pass over to the other side. And I think that's something which we can barely contemplate now.
Yeah, that anecdote really stuck with me, particularly just the preparation as though you're approaching the gallows and you have to make your peace in a way. I think we have a lot that we take for granted nowadays in that we expect to be better at the end of a clinical experience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And I think that's of course what goes to the heart of one of the great questions of the history of medicine, right? About what is cure and what is efficacy. And I think in this period with surgery is a last resort. Almost any surgeon of the period before the 1840s will tell you this is the last resort. There's no such thing as elective surgery, right? You don't go, well, I fancy having this done because I think it might make a difference. You do it because there's no other recourse, right? Because essentially physic has failed, right? Like the kind of medicaments, any other forms of treatment have failed. And actually there are surgeons, you know, John Hunter says it, Abernethy says it, John Abernethy, two great kind of surgeons of the late 18th and early 19th century. They say that surgery is fundamentally, you know, operative surgery is an admission of failure. You haven't been able to treat this any other way. This is the only recourse now. And so, as I say in the book, both surgeons and patients approach operative surgery with a profound sense of pathos and sadness that this is what it's come to. And this is, you know, this is the only recourse. And, you know, you may not live afterwards, but this is, you know, it's either that or something else kills you, the cancer kills you or what have you. So, yes, there's definitely a huge difference in terms of how people approach these things. Both surgeons and patients. Because it's interesting that you talk about preparing for the gallows. John Abernethy says himself, well, apocryphally anyways, in a quote, that he feels as if he's going to be hanged when he goes into surgery. So in a sense, surgeons and patients are both approaching surgery like it's the death sentence, you know, which is, I think, hugely important to kind of bear in mind when thinking about the emotional cultures of the surgical practice in this period.
That's such an interesting emotional meeting from these two very different stakeholders.
Yeah.
You mentioned that one of the things that you kind of, or that you talk about a lot about in your book, kind of an emotional myth that you debunk, is that surgeons were always dispassionate and, you know, removed from the process. What are some of the other emotional myths that you wanted to debunk or did debunk in your book that you want to tell our listeners about?
I guess a lot of historians, I guess, will approach any topic, at least this is my impression, any topic wanting to do something counterintuitive, right? And wanting to say something unexpected and say, oh, well, you think it's like this, but it's not actually, it's like this. It's the opposite of what you think. And actually, in many ways, you know, there's only so much you can do that because there is a reason why we think the things we think about stuff. So I started off wanting to kind of maybe challenge the hegemony of kind of the transformative nature of anesthesia. That becomes impossible because actually anesthesia is undoubtedly transformative on the whole emotional cultures of surgery. But I guess one of the other things I wanted to do is challenge this idea that we are this kind of progressivist or kind of teleological idea about emotions, that we've become kind of more emotionally astute as time has gone on, right? We've become more emotionally sophisticated, more emotionally open and expressive as time has gone on. And actually what I kind of wanted to show is, in a way, emotions played a far more important role in surgery in the early 19th century than they did certainly in surgery in the late 20th and possibly even surgery now. I think things are beginning to change a little bit, but I think actually, you know, the role of emotions on an everyday basis when thinking about patient care or you know, how to deal with a patient, how to talk to a patient, are so much more prominent in the pre-anesthetic era than they are in the period after it. Patient is kind of, you know, knocked out, wheeled in, operated on, wheeled out, right? I mean, I had an operation done during the course of writing this book under general anesthetics, which was a really interesting experience because it's the first time I'd had it done. And I never saw my surgeon, not once, you know? I saw like a surgical registrar who basically took me through the checklist and kind of said, you know, hey, you know, it's general anesthetic, caveats apply, you could die. You probably won't, but you could die. And then, yeah, I saw my anesthetist and then I was out and then I woke up and I never saw anyone again. You know, I do miss my anesthetist now, actually, because I'm in contact with him, but like I've never seen the surgeon. And so that kind of sense of the surgeon just doesn't necessarily involve himself with the patient in the way that, you know, my surgeons in the early 19th century most definitely do, right?
Yeah, it strikes me that there's so much about the modern experience of surgery that is removed from what once was a really traumatic experience, and we're kind of turned off in a way. Mm-hmm. I spent the summer in the operating rooms here watching anesthesiologists at work, and they would have the pre-op conversation, you know, manage the patient's anxieties. But as soon as the drugs were pushed, lights out. And when you wake up, you, even if you did have a conversation with someone, you might not remember it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite remarkable, really, what the drugs can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was fascinating to me to experience that moment of, you know, feeling the coldness in your arm, whether from fentanyl, go, you just, and then that's it, nothing. And the next minute I'm in a room in a completely different place in the hospital, you know? So that was really strange because, you know, I had literally just finished my chapter on anesthesia, and all of those debates that were circulating at the time in the 1840s and still continue to a degree now, right? As to what actually happens to the human brain when you're given anesthetics. And there's lots of people at the time who are like, well, you know, it's possible that you could experience everything, you just don't remember it, you know. And I'm not sure that's still entirely been resolved, that is what happens, you know. So it was very interesting to experience. Well, whatever anyone else experienced, I experienced absolutely nothing that I can remember, that's for sure.
So you alluded to the way that surgeons at this time viewed the patient's state going into an operation as important for their long-term kind of prognosis. I'm curious, did they also view pain as an emotion? And how did that conception change once anesthesia was invented? Also, how was emotion generally used as a clinical sign?
So again, I'll start with the last question first in a way, because I think that establishes some important general context, which is that, as I say, patients are constantly being read for their emotional expressions and their state of mind. I mean, the term emotion isn't always deployed in this period. We can think of it in terms of emotions, and that word is used certainly by the sort of 1840s, much more commonly. But certainly this patient's state of mind is being monitored. One of my big figures in the first part of the book, well, two big figures, the Bell brothers, John and Charles Bell, two Scottish surgeons. John Bell says, you know, that basically you've got to know your patient's emotional state of mind in order to manage their case, in order to kind of not just alleviate their anxieties, but to watch for kind of any signs of despondency, lest they kind of sink and die. And I think one of the things about the clinical emotion as a clinical sign, we talked about preparing patients for surgery, and that's really important. Making sure that your patient knows what to expect. But after the operation as well, they have to be very carefully managed. And that's where there's a real attention to kind of managing their emotions, to watching out for signs, particularly of despondency. Because in an era before there is a conception of kind of post-operative infection, surgeons often explain patients dying after surgery, even after apparently successful surgery, by saying that they became basically depressed. They were constitutionally depressed. You know, their kind of their mood, they became despondent. Of course, all these things are linked. We might now see, well, this is possibly a product of their infection. They become sort of delirious, or they become a kind of, you know, despondent. They become depressed in their emotional state. But they kind of saw the emotions as being preeminent here, that you've got to maintain their resolve to heal in order to kind of make, you know, see them through this process, which is very, very dangerous. In terms of pain, it's a very interesting topic. There's been a huge body of literature on pain. There's been a great deal of debate about what pain is, how it's culturally constructed. Is it an experience? Is it an emotion? Is it a constellation of things? I think where we are at the moment, sort of post work of people like Joanna Bork and Rob Bodis and others, is that, you know, it is both an experience, something you as an individual experience, but it's also a kind of a cultural signifier. You know, it's a kind of system of signification, and how you express it, how your expressions of pain are received, how they're interpreted, vary very much over time. What's interesting to me, this is something I assert in the book, and I'm completely prepared to be challenged on this by anyone who does far more research into this than I did. But my sense is that my surgeons, up until the 1830s and 1840s, aren't very interested in pain. They don't talk about pain very much. They don't talk about a patient's pain because it's ubiquitous, right? If you cut someone's leg off, it's going to hurt. If you cut into someone's, like, you know, perineum with a lancet and stick forceps into their bladder and pull a stone out, it's going to hurt. And so they, in a sense, only really talk about pain as something which patients can conquer. And they admire the capacity, as you say, that stoicism, that resolve, that fortitude of the pain. There are circumstances where it's more interesting to them when it's a kind of clinical sign pre the operation, when it might signify where there is an, you know, where the disease is, or indeed how therapeutics are progressing, or that kind of thing. It's only really, it seems to me, that in the 1840s, and I'm speaking very general terms here, that kind of pain comes into much sharper focus for two reasons I suggest in the book. One is there's a kind of utilitarian argument developing philosophically that pain is bad, right? That pleasure is good, pain is bad, and that anything we can do to promote the former and mitigate the latter is something we should pursue. And so the idea that some of that pain might be something you can eliminate becomes much more kind of at the forefront of surgical consciousness in a way in which it hadn't been, I think, in the previous period, when it just was an accepted part of surgical practice. But weirdly, at the same time, you get a kind of gendering of discourses of pain in this period as well. So this is the period where, you know, hysteria is re-emerging very much as a medical concept, with the ideas of men and women experiencing their bodies differently, experiencing disease differently, experiencing pain differently. And so pain and fortitude become increasingly associated with masculinity and the virtues of masculinity. Because actually prior to the 1840s, you'll find this earlier, but in terms of very general terms, prior to the 1840s, surgeons often say, well, women can endure pain more than men, right? Women are the best at enduring pain. And they point, as you might expect, to childbirth and to the kind of routine experience of extreme pain. And so it's only really in the 1840s that you start getting surgeons go, oh, pain's a kind of masculine virtue. And it's a test of character, you know, and the ability to withstand pain, to endure pain is kind of something that's associated with those things. So it's in the 1840s, pain comes into focus just before its elimination, right, in surgical practice. And so it's one of the great unanswered and probably unanswerable questions of surgical history is why did it take until the 1840s for surgeons to routinely employ inhalation anesthesia, especially since at least 1800, Humphrey Davy had said, well, you know, you take nitrous oxide, you don't feel anything. He even says in writing in 1800, this could be really useful in operations, and no one does anything meaningful about it until American dentists in the 1840s, right? So like it's one of those fascinating questions. And I think in some ways it's partly because pain had just been accepted. Anesthesia transforms pain, of course, because it doesn't just eliminate pain in surgery. It eliminates experience in surgery. It eliminates consciousness in surgery. And so surgery is, for patients, this black hole. So it transforms that experience. But actually what it does to pain, I think, is really interesting. And other people have done some work on this that's very instructive, I think, that it eliminates pain in one very, very particular and specific area of human life, which is operative surgery. It does not eliminate pain in other aspects of human life. So you could endure chronic disease in immense pain, right, for your entire life with very little analgesic relief, aside from opium or alcohol, but you could have your leg cut off and feel nothing. So it's this bizarre thing whereby, you know, it does it in one area, but it doesn't transform patient experience in other senses. And of course, one of the other things it does is, although it obviously, if you know you're not going to feel anything when you're being cut open, it's going to change your attitude towards approaching surgery. But equally, there's a kind of anxiety about anesthesia. Patients have an anxiety about going under. They have an anxiety about suffocation, about the sensation of it, especially obviously in a period when, you know, chloroform is applied, certainly in Scotland, by having someone get literally a cloth like you see in films and put over your mouth until you pass out. You know, it's not a particularly pleasant experience, but it's better, obviously, than experiencing it in fully conscious. So, yeah.
That's also interesting. We realized that we both have experience of this. We both woke up during our wisdom tooth surgeries.
It was brutal.
Horrible.
So what happened? So is this a failure of dental anesthesiology, or is this just customary, you know, experience?
I don't know. I mean, for me, it was, I haven't had anesthesia since then, but they told me I wasn't sensitive enough to it or something. And so I woke up and I couldn't move, but I could open my eye. I opened my eyes and then I was just like leaking tears. And then they put me right back down under, or at least that's how I remember it.
Mm-hmm. And I was also told that I might be a little more resistant to anesthesia. And I just recall the feeling an extraction of a tooth, but not the pain associated, just the the crushing kind of sensation. Yeah.
So eliminated pain, but not consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this goes to the heart of kind of, I guess, you know, it would not surprise you to know that in the 1840s, when ether and later chloroform were introduced, that there's a great deal of uncertainty about what it is, how safe it is. But one of the great debates is, you know, and you see this has been well kind of nicely documented, the work of Martin Pernick in the US and Steffi Snow in the UK, is like, does everyone have the same experience, or is everyone as susceptible? And there's a real attempt by people like John Snow, the British surgeon anaesthetist, to kind of standardize and say, yes, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of, you know, gender you are, how old you are, you know, it could be used equally on everyone. He tries to kind of eliminate subjectivity from anaesthetic experience, but actually we know now that people have subjective experiences, people have tolerances or intolerances, and it isn't this kind of magic bullet that just, I mean, obviously it is to a degree that, you know, better to have it, not to have it, but it isn't just, you know, it's not a simple affair, right? Otherwise there wouldn't be an entire science around it, I guess.
Yeah, and so you've mentioned, especially in related to pain, gender, and how that affects the way that pain was perceived or expected, especially in the mid-19th century. But could you talk a little bit more about how class, race, and gender kind of shaped the emotional expectations of surgeons for their patients? Like, were different expectations placed on different types of patients in this period?
Yeah, I mean, I think personal idiosyncrasies were absolutely kind of, you know, central to the way in which the patient was perceived in the pre-anaesthetic era. So women were treated differently to men, and there was an expectation based around class and racial prejudices, right, that about how people would be expected to handle operations and how they might recover. All the kind of physiology of a patient, their susceptibility to pain, their tolerance of pain, their fortitude, their mental disposition is mapped onto a hierarchy of value, right? About class, about race, about gender. Increasingly about gender as the middle of the century goes on, and also, I guess, probably true of race as well. And it's complicated, right? Because, say, a working class white person might be perceived as, well, if they display fortitude, right, if they don't struggle and they don't scream during the procedure and they steel themselves with great resolve, that might be seen positively, but it also might be interpreted as indicative of their undeveloped nervous system and their kind of, you know, brute insensitivity, right? And the same is true of racial dimensions. My colleague James Kennaway, who's explored surgery and emotion in relation to military surgery, you know, there's a kind of hierarchy by which particularly, you know, racially othered people of colour, you know, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. So if they're hypersensitive to pain, it's because they're effeminate and lacking manly resolve. If they're insensitive to pain, it's because they're like brutes. So there's always a way in which surgical commentators and commentators of the time more generally can kind of subvert these categories in order to put white Anglo-Saxons at the top and everyone in a hierarchy below. And I saw this particularly with Irish patients, so Irish Catholic, specifically Catholic patients, not only in the Irish context, but also in the English context, which is what I was mostly looking at, the Anglo-Scottish context, and where you have large numbers of Irish immigrants. They will often be spoken about as patients who are particularly obstreperous, particularly difficult, particularly lacking in self-control and self-resolve. And so they're kind of difficult, they're difficult patients, and that's explicitly linked to their what is perceived to be their inferior character and breeding, right? So there's a very clear sense in which all of these things are linked to kind of hierarchies of value established by white men. And I think this has been done very nicely. I mean, as far back in the 1980s as Martin Pernick's book, A Calculus of Suffering, about an introduction of anaesthesia in the US, he's very good on the sort of debates around, you know, people of colour and do they need anaesthesia? Does it work the same on them as it works on white people? You know, there is a sense in which these things are very strongly linked to racial prejudices and kind of, yeah, hierarchies of value attached to race and class.
Thank you so much for that.
So I'm curious about, in particular, you have a lot of anecdotes in your work, but there was one that stuck with me regarding social movements, particularly with Joseph Lister. He was, in my understanding, a proponent of vivisection. For our listeners, that's experimentation on living animals. It's quite grisly. And also opposed the women's movement at the time. So can you comment on that and why you felt it was important to include in your narrative?
Yes. Yeah, Lister was, he was more than just supportive of vivisection. I mean, he was an active vivisector and an active member of the Association for the Advancement of Medical Research, which was basically, in the UK, vivisection's championing body, established to defend vivisection, the practice of vivisection, against kind of challenges from various quarters. So yeah, I mean, for him, vivisection was absolutely central to his physiological understanding of the human body. I mean, for those of listeners who don't know who Joseph Lister is, Joseph Lister is a kind of pivotal figure in the history of surgery in particular, but more generally the history of Western medicine, in that he was the pioneer of antisepsis. So in the period in which I work, my work straddles the kind of late 18th to the late 19th century, by the middle of the 19th century, surgery, my argument is that surgical recovery is still being conceived of largely in constitutional terms. Whether you survive an operation or not is to do with your kind of mental state and all these other kind of complex constitutional factors. Whereas Lister comes along and says, actually, what's to blame for people dying after surgery is there's these little germs in the air, right? And I know that because I read Louis Pasteur. They're hanging around in the air and they will deposit themselves on your body, including on the wounds that you've had, you know, produced through surgical intervention. They will putrefy that wound, produce an infection, produce sepsis or erysipelas or whatever else, and kill you. And the job of the surgeon is to protect you from that infection by the use of things like carbolic acid to kind of kill those germs and what have you, and careful management of the wound. And so Lister is this really pivotal figure. He's the kind of the leading kind of figure in surgical modernity in the late 19th century. And he's seen widely as a hero, right? He's seen as a hero at the time. He's the first surgeon to be raised to the peerage, sit in the House of Lords as for being a surgeon. And he's been celebrated by generations of surgeons since. And that's all great. And it's well-deserved. He did a lot for alleviating human suffering. But some of the more culturally, temporally specific aspects of his character and his practice have been smoothed off or erased, I think, a lot of the popular lore. And as you say, one of those is his avid support for vivisection. And relatedly, his opposition to female medical training and in general to the women's movement. And the reason for this, the reason I wanted to include these two things is because one of the greatest challenges to late 19th century medicine and surgery in Britain is mounted by a coalition of actors who are linked, who basically unite anti-vivisection and women's rights. And a key figure here would be someone like Francis Power Cobb, early suffragist and opponent of vivisection. And they are linked by one of the claims of at the time as to why women don't need the vote is that men are there to look after them, right? Women don't need a voice because men are their voice, right? Men are their guardians, and men have their interests at heart, as it were, right? They'll look after them and make sure that they don't come to harm. And of course, what early suffrage campaigners point to is the fact that medical men increasingly can't be trusted to have women's interests at heart. And one of the key examples here is the Contagious Diseases Act, right? So in the 1860s, there's increasing concern that soldiers in the British Army are getting venereal disease from sleeping with infected sex workers. And so the state's response to this isn't to say men should stop having sex with sex workers. It's to say that sex workers should not have venereal disease and we should go out of our way to make sure that they are clean. And so this law is introduced that basically any sex worker in a port or barrack town, so somewhere the army or the navy might be found, can be effectively arrested, inspected physically by a medical practitioner, and then incarcerated in a lock hospital, i.e. a venereal disease hospital, if they're found to be suffering from venereal disease until they recover. All of this without trial, without any kind of judicial process. Basically to make sure that there aren't quote unquote unclean kind of sex workers wandering the streets that might infect our brave, you know, Tommy Atkins or Jack Tar. And actually, this outrages feminist opinion because this is seen as, you know, quite clearly and rightfully a kind of an assault on women's autonomy, bodily autonomy, social autonomy, and also a kind of absolute indication of the sexual double standard, whereas it's women's sexuality and bodies that are being policed, not men's. So this is a kind of example that the involvement of medical practitioners in this movement is one thing that kind of really starts to generate a lot of ill feeling towards the medical profession among early feminists. Equally, the practice of vivisection, so, you know, dissecting animals while they are conscious, while they're alive, in order to find out about things like the nervous system or the digestive system or other physiological processes, which is a well-established history that goes back deep into time, but which is being practiced with increasing openness and self-confidence by medical practitioners by the second half of the 19th century. They see this as another example of kind of men's cruelty, effectively, medical men's cruelty. And Rob Bodice has done some very good work on this in terms of the vivisection in particular. But there is a language of emotion. This all of this discourse is saturated by a language of emotion, right? So medical men who defend vivisection present themselves as rational, masculine actors who are doing things for the greater good, whereas these hysterical women are irrational and overly sentimental and are focusing on the wrong thing, right, which is the suffering animal as opposed to the suffering human. And so all of this stuff is bound up in a figure like Lister, who's both a kind of heroic figure, but also a controversial one because of his, you know, support for vivisection. And his objection to, I have to kind of thank Anne Crowther and Marguerite Dupree for their book on Lister for alerting me to his quite vigorous opposition to female he's a ardent supporter of the Contagious Diseases Act, it will not surprise you to know as well. And he hopes that they can be reintroduced even after they're repealed, and hopes they can be reintroduced across the whole of the country. I think these things are important. I'll get back to the subject of emotions here, because not only are they couched in emotional terms, but my argument in the book is that, you know, in order to kind of meet this challenge, Lister and his acolytes, and he has many of them, and they are very vocal and very active, present him as a saintly, almost godlike figure who is beyond reproach, right? He is beyond reproach because he is divine, and he is God's kind of, you know, he's God's tool on earth to alleviate human suffering. One of his students, and I quote him in the book later in the early in the 20th century, says, you know, that just as there is a time, you know, BC and AD, a time before Christ and a time after Christ, there is a time before Lister and a time after Lister. You know, and people talk about him explicitly messianic terms. And so I think what I was interested in is how kind of Lister's reputation is gilded in emotional terms as this man of great compassion, infinite compassion, infinite feeling. And I see that as, I don't want to be too instrumentalist about it, but it's not coincidental that that medical practitioners at the time are being criticized for being unfeeling and cold and calculating and, you know, cruel. And so there's a kind of attempt to answer that, I think, by presenting him as the ultimate man of compassion.
Yeah, I found all of the Lister-isms, I suppose, through the book really interesting, and all the myths kind of surrounding him really fascinating.
Yeah, I really liked that example for, you know, getting behind the lionizing of a very famous man from the past to show how so much of the paternalist kind of misogyny that went into medical education was very ripe at the time.
Yeah.
I'm curious now, like, since we're characterizing surgeons and their kind of emotions towards each other, can you comment on how it was, or your process in pulling apart emotion from patient testimony and from memoirs written by surgeons and patients? Is that a process that is limited by the physician's perspective as kind of a experimenter or investigator of the patient?
Yes, is the short answer. That recovering the patient's narrative is one of the greatest challenges of the history of medicine. And any historian, Christy will be able to tell you this, that any historian of medicine is a challenge that we face about how can we access the patient's voice when so much of the material that's come down to us is written by practitioners. I was fortunate in one sense that I had a really rich archival resource in the Royal College of Surgeons archive in London, and particularly the kind of the archival collections of Astley Cooper for the first part of my period. He has this incredibly rich base of correspondence from his patients, so patients writing letters to him. We don't have his letters to them, but we have their letters to him, which kind of at least reverses that traditional dynamic when it comes to material that we tend to encounter. But there's no doubt that most of these letters are written by educated middle classes and elites, right? Literate people. And we don't get the voices so much of, you know, non-literate peoples, non-elite peoples, people of colour, working class people. Where we see them, we tend to see them filtered through case notes written by surgeons. And that's a challenge, because we don't necessarily hear their voice. But I think if we read between the lines of this material, as I tried to do, and read, you know, kind of against the grain with some of it, we can at least get a sense of how their emotions, how their emotional states are being conceived and sort of responded to. And there's a section in the book, for example, where I talk about Astley Cooper's relationship with his female hospital patients based on his case notes, where he puts emotion, you know, at the forefront of explaining not only how patients respond to treatment, but actually how their disease is generated. So he's particularly interested in breast cancer, and he sees breast cancer as, in a sense, a product of being emotionally overwhelmed, you know, by grief, by despondency, by other kinds of factors. And actually particularly things like anxiety, maternal anxiety. So I think we have to kind of be careful about how we read these things. For the later period, my argument is effectively that other people have made this argument from a different perspective, but patient testimony does become less important. What the patient thinks about their disease, how they think it was caused, how they feel about it, how they feel about approaching surgery, just simply doesn't appear in the archive so much, because they're effectively been silenced, firstly by anesthesia, and secondly, I would argue, by antisepsis and by this absolute resolute focus on the wound as the site of therapeutic intervention. And basically, as Lister says, you can ignore the rest of the patient. The rest of the patient isn't really that important for considering what you're going to do. Because if a patient has, you know, has got an infected wound, you treat the wound. You don't treat their state of mind, right? That's an ancillary concern. So yes, my argument would be that as the century goes on, that patient's voice and the patient's emotional state begins to disappear from the historical record, right? Because it isn't a primary concern of clinicians. And I still don't think is a primary concern of clinicians to this day.
That is a perfect segue to our last couple of questions that we have, where we want to think about potential continuities to medical practice today from your research.
Yes. So Dr. Brown, I'm curious, moving from the archives to the here and now, have you talked with surgeons about your work? And if so, what has been their reaction to hearing this history?
Yes, I have talked to quite a few surgeons about it. So this book emerges from a Wellcome Trust funded project called Surgery in Emotion, which ran between 2016 and 2021. And it was expressly designed to engage with practicing surgeons today and engaging in current debates about the place of emotion within surgery. What I found was actually a very receptive audience. Surgeons are very receptive to thinking about and talking about their own past. I don't know if they're uniquely interested. I think a lot of medical practitioners are interested in the history of medicine to a degree, greater or less degree. But I certainly think that surgeons I've found them to be very engaged in their own past. And actually, when I started the project, you know, we were fortunate in that actually there was a debate emerging already within surgery about what role do emotions play in structuring relationships between practitioners within professional relations, and what role do they play in structuring relationships between practitioners and patients. So we had some very, very constructive conversations, and indeed a couple of workshops, and Christy was at one of them, at least one of them, maybe two, I can't remember. So we spoke a lot to surgeons. And they were also very interested in aspects of the research. There were some surgeons who are just very interested in history generally and interested in all aspects of it. And there are other surgeons who have a slightly more instrumentalist approach to what can this do for me and how can this inform current debates and so on. My general feeling was that I was both pleased and slightly disappointed by aspects of my engagement with the profession. Because understandably, right, people come with their own agendas. My agenda is, as a historian, is to basically to understand the past on its own terms, but also to think about how it connects with the present. Their agenda is, you know, informed by debates going on within their own profession. And it seemed to me that most surgeons were interested in interprofessional dynamics, right? How emotions and things structure surgical experience, how they structure things like bullying, or kind of OR relations, you know, team relations within medical practice, surgical practice. They were interestingly less interested in the bits that I was most interested in, which were how emotions structure relationships between surgeons and their patients. And I actually found that most people who were interested in that side of things weren't practicing surgeons, but were kind of in the, you know, the milieu of medical and surgical practice. I think most surgeons kind of just assumed that by operating on someone and saving their life, that they were being compassionate. Do you know what I mean? Like that was an act of compassion. That was an act of care. And actually, I think that's a template that I argue the book is kind of established from Lister onwards, that surgery is de facto compassionate by the fact that it saves lives, and that they didn't need to think in any real detail about how they actually interact with patients on an emotional level or take their emotions seriously, because one, we're treating them, we're saving their lives. What else do they want? And so I think while there's a lot going on in surgery, a lot of debates that we were party to about maybe sort of dealing with the emotional complexities of surgical practice, there's still a kind of rather instrumentalist approach, I think, to treatment and care that tends to occlude emotions or kind of lessen their place. Yeah.
That was such a good answer. And so much so that we're like, that was a really good conclusion to the episode. I'm still going to ask our last question, but I thought that was a really good wrap up. But so in your book, you speak about how the introduction of anesthesia changed the surgeon-patient relationship. And so today there are so many medical technologies that continue, you know, in different ways to put distance between the surgeon and the patient. So think of things like robotic or remote surgery, right? So how do you think that understanding the emotions history that you tell around anesthesia and that you tell in this book in general can help those training to become surgeons or who are already working as surgeons to understand that vital role of emotions and technology in their care of patients?
That's a really interesting question. And it's one which I was trying to do a little bit of work with surgeons on when COVID hit. We had some workshops planned, talking to surgical trainees about things such as, you know, what role emotions in a world of robotic surgery and VR and all that kind of stuff. I think what's really interesting is you've got two, and I'm not an expert on, you know, modern surgical practice by any stretch of the imagination, but speaking to surgeons and from my limited knowledge, what was seemed to me to be particularly interesting is that there are developments that are both sort of reducing the connections between patients, practitioners and their patients, but also bringing them back together again. So, you know, we don't use general anesthetics as routinely as we used to, right? You know, we have things like local anesthetics and nerve blocks and other kinds of things where you can practice surgery and have the patient kind of conscious. And I had some very interesting conversations with practicing surgeons about how you deal with that, how you deal with a patient who is conscious in the operating theatre, if you're used to them being unconscious. And sometimes I had one orthopedic surgeon who was saying, you know, that they'll have like a screen up sort of covering up the bit that's being operated on. The patient will be sort of conscious and they'll be sort of reaching over almost unconsciously to the bit where the rest of their body is being operated on. And they sort of have to sort of bat their hand away and actually there's almost a return to, okay, how do you deal with a kind of a conscious agentive presence in the operating theatre in a way that, you know, hasn't been there for some time. So I think at one level, sort of VR and robotics are kind of creating these distances, but in other levels, we're kind of seeing greater connections and intersubjectivity being reintroduced back into surgery. I mean, I would hope, and I say this in the book as a kind of concluding hope, that, you know, that surgeons will learn to take, if they take anything from the book, it's the idea that actually there are things to learn from the past and that it isn't just about, you know, what we did wrong and how we can, you know, avoid doing those wrong things again. It's actually about maybe what we've lost as much as what we've gained in the, you know, undeniable progress we've made. And one thing I'd be keen, as I say, not to kind of have anyone believe is that I think surgery before 1846 was better, right, than surgery now. It is obviously manifestly not the case. But I think that we, you know, we can see in the past something positive about emotional relations between practitioners and their patients, but also I think encouraging emotional reflection and introspection among surgeons. And I wouldn't want that to get in the way of basically being able to do the job. And I do understand completely why surgeons might want to sort of quarantine themselves from the more troubling aspects of their work, and having to deal with other people's suffering is exhausting, I'm sure of it. But I think being kind of
developing or encouraging an emotional intelligence by which we can think about these things, talk about these things. It's astonishing to read 19th century surgeons, early 19th century surgeons like Charles Bell, talking about how they felt after a procedure, that they were devastated, or that it's the hardest thing they can imagine, dealing with the death of a patient, openly talking about their feelings and it not having undermined their surgical reputation, to be open and expressive about these things. And I think if we can learn anything, it's that actually that is, you know, that's something that we can value and maybe take forward.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. This has been wonderful to hear. I think it really, for me as a medical student, kind of translates to how we can reflect on our emotions in preparing to treat patients.
Yeah, it's a deeply emotionally demanding thing, right? And for patients and practitioners alike. And I think I'm not asking people to sort of, you know, to weep in front of their patients. Although maybe there's a time for crying with your patients when you give them bad news. You know, maybe that's not such a bad thing, and it shouldn't be seen as a failure of kind of professional, you know, demeanor to do that. But I certainly think that being open and, yeah, as you say, thinking about it, taking it seriously, and maybe actually introducing it as part of, you know, medical education and not just a tick box exercise, but something, you know, encouraging those kind of levels of humanist reflection is no bad thing.
Absolutely. It's almost like you gave a plug just then for my whole department.
Yeah, well, exactly. Exactly. God knows we need it. We need it.
That's what we're doing here.
Yeah, absolutely.
In this medical school. Anyway, thank you so much for chatting with us. We really appreciate it. And we enjoyed reading your book.
Glad to hear it.
And yeah, it was a pleasure.